Shalom and welcome again to another edition of the Jewish Sacred Aging Podcast. A reminder that you can follow us on www.jewishsacredaging.com and also on the Jewish Sacred Aging page on Facebook. And today I'm very, very pleased to welcome to our podcast my classmate, Rabbi Sally Presand. And we're here to talk about the book from the CCIR called Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate. Sally, thank you for joining us and welcome to the podcast for Jewish Sacred Aging. It's good to speak with you. How are you doing?
I'm doing just fine. Thank you so much for inviting me to be with you today.
Well, it's always a pleasure to speak to a classmate. Full disclosure, Sally was part of the, as I always refer to it, the dynamic class of 1972 at the Hebrew Union College. And it's been a long, long time ago in, as they say, a galaxy somewhat far away. But it's been an interesting journey. And let me go right to that. 44 years ago, Sally, we walked off the Bima at Plum Street Temple in Cincinnati, and you've certainly traveled an amazing journey. Looking back a little bit, if I could push you a little bit as to try to say what would you say were the greatest accomplishments, basically in these last 44 years, and everything you've seen, and what would be perhaps one of your greatest regrets?
Well, I think probably the greatest accomplishment is that we now have over 1,000 female rabbis throughout the world, representing not only the reform movement, but also the conservative, the reconstructionists, and now today the modern Orthodox, which is really very exciting. And it's wonderful to be able to know that we've opened doors of opportunities so that little girls can grow up knowing if they want to be rabbis, they can be. In fact, in my temple, I had, for most of the time that I was rabbi of Monmouth Reform Temple, I had a female cantor. And so I used to tell parents, please be certain to take your children to other synagogues so they can see that men can do these jobs too.
Thank you very much.
And so, you know, when I look back, I'm very conscious of the fact that I happen to be in the right place at the right time, and I was the first. But I'm very energized and inspired by all of my female colleagues and grateful to know that we have opened new doors of opportunity. At the same time, I try not to lose sight of the larger mission of the Jewish people, which is to bring a sense of holiness to the world and to make it better for everyone.
And if you would just share with me, given all that, what regret perhaps stands out in this career?
I'm not certain that I really have any regrets. I will say that in the beginning years of my career, I made most decisions on the basis of what is good for women in the rabbinate and not necessarily what is good for me. Because I was quite conscious of the fact that the people were looking at me and that whatever their experience was when they walked out the door, that was what they were going to take with them to form their opinion about female rabbis. In terms of that, probably the biggest decision that I made was not to marry and have children. And when I was in rabbinic school and in the early years, I certainly, if you go back and read some of the interviews, it says quite clearly that I intended to get married and have children, and that in my synagogue there was going to be a nursery next to my study. So it was something that I had intended to do, but when I got out there and started serving God and the Jewish people, I discovered that I was not able to do both, have a career and a family, and do them well. That's just me. And I think it's really important for people to know themselves. And I admire the women who can do both, but I just know it's not me. And I don't really have a regret about that, because I know that all of the people I've touched, all the children I have taught, they're all part of my extended family now.
And it's very interesting that you say that and put it in that context as the first, as the pioneer, because, you know, as we both travel extensively and to give speeches and talks and workshops, it is now expected and contractually with leaves, you know, that female colleague built into contracts of maternity leave, et cetera, et cetera. And I guess that's part of this wholesale sea change in these last 44 years, that's part of it.
That's true, but I also, you know, I think it's even gone beyond that, because I know that in some congregations they are willing, they put in the contract parental leave, making it possible for male rabbis to take time to bond with their child.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the whole change, not just socially and culturally, that we've lived through since our ordination. You know, the change in the American Jewish community since 1972, when we walked off the Bima at Plum Street, has been phenomenal. What is different, and how things have changed on a whole variety of different levels, not only the rabbinate, but the relationship with lay people to the rabbinate, which is extremely crucial and very important. And talk to me a little bit about the book, The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate, the CCAR Press. It's part of this Challenge and Change series. And for people who don't know the book yet, and it really is an essential book, I think, for every colleague's library, regardless of denomination, it's very, very, there's a huge amount of resources and authorship, male and female. How did you get involved with this? I mean, obviously, the CCAR Press came to you. Can you talk a little bit about the book and how it evolved?
Well, the book itself was not my idea. I think our colleague Renee Edelman was the person who came up with this idea, and Rebecca Shore and Alyssa Graff were the ones who edited the book, and of course the support of Hera Person at the CCAR Press. And I was asked to write the foreword, and then I gave permission to include in the book an interview that I gave once with the Women's Rabbinic Network. They call it in this book the historic interview. And I want to emphasize the fact that what I think is so important about this book is that it is a book of history. And it tells the whole story of women in the rabbinate, all of the challenges that we faced at the beginning and the challenges that we still face today. And what I think is so wonderful about it is that, as you said, both women and men have contributed to the book. I appreciated the chapter that you wrote, representing our class. And I think sometimes in terms of our class, I have different memories. I've sort of blocked out everything. I'm always really positive about the experience that I had. And I remember that when people used to tell me why they thought women shouldn't be rabbis or couldn't be rabbis, I would listen respectfully and then say, thank you for your opinion, and walk away. Because I've always believe that you don't really change minds by arguing. You just have to go out and do it. So a lot of that kind of history is included in this book, and we know that Dr. Nelson Glick, who was president of a college institute when we were in school, really is the man most responsible for the ordination of women. And the way that it worked in the reform movement, if you go back, it was completely a decision of the college institute. The other branches of our movement didn't really have anything to say about it. I'm not always certain that that was the best way to go about it. I contrast that with the way the conservative movement went about it, although they didn't ordain Amy Eilberg until 13 years after I was ordained. They took a period of time to study the issue, to talk to congregations about it, so that when she was ordained, they were ready to welcome women rabbis. When I was ordained, it just was something that came on the Jewish scene, and nobody was really prepared for it. And therefore, I always had to be the first to experience everything.
How much of a pressure was that on you?
I think it really, as I said, it was a lot of pressure because I'm a very private person.
Oh, yes, I know.
And this is the paradox of my personality. Very private, but on the other hand, I chose a very public profession. And, you know, in the last year of school, first year of being a rabbi, I traveled a lot around the country, feeling it was my responsibility for people to see me and to understand that not really, I was quite human, just like everyone else. And I think that helped to lay the groundwork, at least make people more aware of what the possibilities are. But as you said, you know, lots of things today are very different than they were before. I'm thinking about our class and our class picture, how today the ritual of Talit and Kippah, that is so prevalent today. And in our class, when you look at the picture of 36, I think there were three people who wore Talit. And you'll remember that those kinds of things, even among the faculty, were not permitted.
Oh, I remember very well.
under Dr. Glick's presidency. And that it was always a very difficult thing for me that he died the year before I was ordained, we were ordained, because one of the things that got me through the 8 years since I went to the University of Cincinnati also was in my mind that picture of one day he's going to put his hands on my shoulders and I'm going to be a rabbi. And so it was quite devastating to me when he died the year before. But his wife told me that there were three things he said that he wanted to live to do, and one of them was to ordain me.
Yeah, I know you write about this lovingly in the foreword. And I'll tell you, you know, I remember you just mentioned it. I'm flashing back in my mind to the class meetings that we used to have sometime in our senior year and our last year at HUC. And, you know, the wondering about, and you were on the road, I remember a lot in our last year of HUC. They had you really traveling all over the place.
Yes.
About how much of a sacrifice that really was, because it was a part of the class stuff, just the messing around. But you were on. It's like you were on all the time, even in class sometimes.
Well, I will tell you that in Dr. Gutmann's Talmud class, I always felt that none of you prepared, because every single time he called on me.
Well, how he prepared, that's another story. I mean, not for this podcast, but there's a Xerox machine that used to be on the fourth floor of the library building at HUC that many of us stopped at regularly on our way to Talmud class to Xerox the Sansino translation, just in case we were called on. The trouble is,
I didn't didn't know you didn't share that with me. I didn't know about that. No,
the problem is, I remember one of our classmates who shall remain nameless was actually was called on to recite, and I think it was Dr. Gutmann, or maybe it was Dr. Wacholder, one of the two, both of a blessed memory. And you know, who knew then? They had memorized the whole Talmud. So when this guy tried to fumble his way through the translation, says, no, the word you're reading is really six pages down in the third line of the fifth word in. I remember looking at, I think it was Kotak or something, and we just said, okay, we're done. We're done. Just bury your head.
I do also remember that when I was traveling, you all would tape my class, would tape the class for me, so that I wouldn't really miss anything. Of course, when there were things that especially Dr. Gutmann wanted to say to a room full of men,
yes,
you would turn it off. He would say, turn it off, and then you would turn it back on.
Well, one of the things I wanted to ask you, because there's this very interesting essay towards the end of the book, this, and the book is 700 pages, so let people know that. There's a very interesting essay about double standards and pay equality, and your experience and your work in with the women in the rabbinate. There's still a double standard when it comes to pay and compensation, is there?
Yes, there is. We did a survey a couple of years ago, and if I remember correctly, the number was that female rabbis make about 80% of what male rabbis make. And so it's not unlike the larger society of which we are part. And we see very much in the presidential campaign right now that one of the issues is equal pay for equal work. And so I think that that is still one of the areas in which we have a lot to do. Even as we've made progress, especially in the last year or two, there are many female rabbis who have been appointed the senior rabbi of large congregations. And I think that that's a wonderful step forward. Of course, I have no idea what kind of salary they're making, but I think it's a wonderful step forward. And I think that it's not always the wish of a female rabbi to take a large congregation. For example, I always thought that that was my responsibility as the first woman rabbi. And when I came to Monmouth Reformed Temple in Tinton Falls, New Jersey, nobody ever expected, including myself, that I would stay here for my career. But the congregation taught me that success doesn't really mean bigger. You know, when we were in school, that was what was pounded into us all the time.
Absolutely.
That you're not a success unless you get that large congregation. My congregation here taught me that success really just means, are we doing better today than we did yesterday? And I'm always grateful for that lesson. They embraced me, welcomed me, allowed me to be their rabbi, not a woman rabbi. And you know, sometimes I was only reminded of that historic position when I would go to a URJ biennial or a CCAR conference.
You mentioned a lot of the changes. One of the changes that are still happening, and this is recent too, and it's mentioned in the book, in one of the essays in the book, about the change in language of the Semicha.
Yes, that was a very interesting story. Thanks to our colleague, Rabbi Mary Zamor. I did not know this. When we were ordained, I knew that I would be receiving an empty tube without a certificate, because I had been told the week before. What I was told, or at least what I remember, is that I was told they had forgotten to change all of the language to the feminine. And, you know, I accepted that. And when I did finally get it, I knew that I, you know, it said Ra Vumo Ra. There's no vowels, so I thought all of you got Ra Vumo Ra. I had absolutely no idea that all of you got the traditional Morenu Harav. I did not know that until a couple years ago when Mary brought that to my attention.
And that has now changed.
And this is the first year, due to her diligence and dedication, that everybody gets the same now. And I believe that women are permitted to choose if they want to be called Rav or Rabah.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's just another sign, I think, that our movement is committed to complete equality. And there are these little things that just pop up that we don't know about.
On the issue of equality, there's another very, very interesting essay in the book by our colleague from Israel. I think she's in Modi'in, Kinneret Shiryon.
Yeah.
That talks about the struggle, I guess that's the right word still, in Israel of equality. Have you done a lot of work with our female colleagues in Israel?
I have not. I've tried to be supportive. I belong to Women of the Wall and very much admire all. In fact, what I always say to our female colleagues in Israel is that they're the real pioneers.
Mm.
I've also said that to male colleagues, our classmate, David Foreman, Alava
Shalom,
in founding Rabbis for Human Rights and all of those kinds of things, to me, they're the real pioneers. And Kinneret has done a tremendous amount. Well, all of our female colleagues have. Rabbi Miri Gold have fought the fight for being paid as the Orthodox rabbis are paid by the government. Now, the Women of the Wall is a good example of, I was always concerned about when they were going to give this space, you know, the new space that you could have men and women praying together. I really didn't believe they were ever going to go through with it, and now obviously it's turned back into a fight.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the lessons that we learn, and this is actually an important lesson for me that I've held on to throughout my rabbinate. We know in Torah we read the story of the daughters of Tzelophehad. And when their father died, he had no sons, and according to the laws of inheritance, they were not going to get his share. And they spoke up and went to Moses, and Moses consulted God, and God said, they're right, give them their share. What that means to me is that change comes about only when those who are being discriminated against demand it. And so it's a very good reminder to all of us that if you want something to change, you can't just sit back. You have to stand up and speak out.
Talking about change is one thing I also wanted to get your take on. And there's another wonderful essay in the book by a colleague, Deborah Reed Blank, on the emergence of new rituals and reinterpreting rituals. How much do you think of this surge in new ritual creation? I see this in a lot in the Jewish sacred aging work with this explosion of new rituals for new life stages. But it really comes on the heels, I think, of a lot of the creativity as a result of the Jewish feminist movement. Where do you see the role of female rabbis in these last 44 years as being one of the engines that have driven this sense of creativity?
I think you're absolutely right. It's the presence of female rabbis has been an impetus to create new rituals. We are a tradition of many rituals, and to me, ritual is really what sets us apart from other traditions, because obviously all traditions believe in the basic ethical values of life. But our rituals set us apart. And I think as women began to be ordained, there was a recognition that for many of the significant moments in a girl's life or a woman's life, there were no rituals. And so the creative rabbis among us began to develop them. And I think for many, they've been welcomed and needed. And I think they've brought women back to Judaism.
Well, I don't think there's any question about that.
They have enabled women who felt disenfranchised to feel that they had a place. And I think that's one of the important things about our tradition, that that change has never been static. It is ongoing. You know, one of my pet peeves is when somebody refers to Reformed Judaism.
Yes. Yeah.
And I always say it's reform because it's not in the past tense. We're still in the process of reforming and refashioning our tradition to make it relevant for today.
Sally, let me conclude the podcast. I just want to ask you to reflect upon something you mentioned, which evidently had quite an impact upon you. You wrote about it towards the end of your essay, in the foreword essay in The Sacred Calling. And that is this trip to Berlin to study about Rabbi Jonas. Could you just walk us through that and why that was so powerful to you?
Well, I think another one of the effects that Jewish feminism has had is we've had an opportunity to discover role models. And one of those role models is Rabbi Regina Jonas, who was really the first woman rabbi. And she was ordained, she was supposed to be ordained in Germany by the Hochschule. She wrote a thesis on can women serve as rabbis, and of course she set out to prove the affirmative, and I read the thesis, and many of the arguments that I used to use and other women used to use are all right there. And so we immediately felt a kinship with her. She was eventually ordained. Unfortunately, her mentor died the year before she was to be ordained, just like my mentor, Dr. Glick. And there were many similarities, actually, between our two lives. Her mentor died. The school would not ordain her. And eventually she was ordained by Rabbi Max Dieneman of Offenbach, the head of the Liberal Rabbis Association. And she was not permitted, at the beginning she was permitted only to serve in hospitals, homes for the elderly, etc. And then as male rabbis began to be deported, she was welcomed into the synagogues, and she made quite a reputation for herself in terms of preaching and pastoral work. Then she was sent to Terezin, and later to Auschwitz, where she was murdered. So a group of rabbis under the direction of the Jewish Women's Archive and the American Jewish Archives, this was the idea of Rabbi Gary Zola, we went to Germany to follow in her footsteps. And the four firsts, as I refer to the first woman rabbi of each of our four movements, we helped to dedicate a plaque at Terezin so that Rabbi Jonas would take her rightful place in the chain of Jewish tradition. Now, what we are trying to do now is we would like to observe her yard site from year to year and ask Jews of all denominations to do the same. We were unable to determine exactly when she died. With the help of Yad Vashem and the Holocaust Museum in Washington, we discovered that she was sent to Auschwitz on October 12th, 1944, and her name is on the transport list. And we assume that when she arrived on October 14th, that she was murdered immediately. And October 14th was Shabbat Bereshit.
Wow.
And therefore, we have decided that Shabbat Bereshit would be the appropriate time to observe her yard site. And we are asking congregations to do that. And so I hope everyone hearing this will ask, will go to their congregation and ask that her name be included. Her whole story is included in the book.
Right.
And I just want to end by saying that, as you mentioned, the book is like 800 pages. It's a very large book. And I know some people have spoken to me about using it for their book clubs. And my recommendation is to choose one section of the book for your book club, because I think it's going to be very difficult to read this book at one sitting.
But it's a great adult education tool, and the timeline. There's a really, really powerful and very well done timeline called Women Rabbis List of Firsts that outlines the whole from the 30s, the mid 30s on to the contemporary world. Rabbi Sally Priesand, I want to thank you very, very much for being a guest here on our Jewish Sacred Aging podcast. The book is called The Sacred Calling, Four Decades of Women in the Rabbinate, CCAR Challenge and Change Series. You can get it through the CCAR Press. Sally, is this on Amazon, the great God Amazon?
Yes, I believe it is.
Yes, everything's available on Amazon. And once again, you can follow us on www.jewishsacredaging.com on the internet, and also the Jewish Sacred Aging Facebook page. Rabbi Sally Priesand, thank you very, very much, my fellow classmate. Take care, be well, have a good summer, stay healthy. And to all of you, thank you. Shalom. We'll hope to see you again soon on the next podcast here on Jewish Sacred Aging. Thank you.